Go ahead and turn with me to Numbers chapter 5. Numbers chapter 5. We begin this morning at verse 1. Now, before we begin reading our text, let me just point out that this fifth chapter can actually be broken down into two or three different parts, depending on how much detail you're wanting to glean from it. The broader focus, though, is on maintaining the ritual purity of the Israelites, both physically and spiritually. Beyond that, we can actually break the text down into three main sections. The first is verses 1 through 4, which is concerned with the Israelites separating themselves from those deemed unclean. And then the second section, which is verses 5 to 10, addresses the process of restitution between an offender and the one offended or injured. And finally, in verses 11 through 31, the Lord provides the Israelites with instruction on how to deal with suspected marital infidelity. Let's go ahead and begin our reading there at verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper and everyone having a discharge and everyone who is unclean because of a dead person. You shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst." The sons of Israel did so and sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did. Now let's go ahead and stop there. As we've discussed in previous studies, the concept of being ceremonially clean was very important to the Israelites. Why? Well, because being physically and spiritually clean were actually reflections on the holiness of God. God deemed that his people would be as like him as they could be, which means that they must be spiritually and physically free from every defect possible. I know this is something that we don't really focus on as much today, but I think we should. Certainly the spiritual component, I would say, we have a firm grasp on. But many of you have probably heard the expression, cleanliness is next to godliness. This was actually a phrase that was used by John Wesley, most famously, in 1778. But it goes beyond that. It's a much older saying, and it simply means just what I said. It's this idea that to be clean on the outside simply bodes well for us in terms of the message that we carry about God's own holiness. Now, there's not a direct correlation there. I suppose if you want to be dirty, you can be dirty. If you want to, you know, dress in a disheveled manner, you can do that. But I do think, and this is probably my age speaking, but I do think that, especially when the people of God gather together, we should look our best. We should take a bath, take a shower, shave, come to church in such a configuration that we are representing who God is on the outside. Now, that's not to say that we need to focus extensively on the outside, because as Jesus said to the Pharisees, they were whitewashed tombs. Everything is clean on the outside, but on the inside are nothing but dead men's bones. I think we can fall into that same trap if we're not careful by putting more emphasis on the external than on the internal. But what God wants the Israelites to do is focus on a balance. He wants them to be clean inside and out, and that's demonstrated in the provisions that are made here. Now, being clean also has a lot of good health benefits. If you're not hygienic, you can suffer all kinds of maladies, particularly those on the largest organ that makes up your body, and that's your skin. Leprosy was very common during this day. And understand, leprosy is not simply the Hansen's disease that we know leprosy to be today. Leprosy was a reference to any condition in which the skin was scabbed over, oozing, rashes were present, those things fall under the umbrella of leprosy. And to have a leprous condition, which might or might not be, again, the true disease of leprosy, but to be in a leprous condition rendered you ceremonially unclean. You weren't allowed to come in the midst of the people. You weren't allowed to come into the worship of the people. You weren't allowed to participate in the various rituals that the people enjoyed, the ceremonies and all the things that went with their observance of Judaism. You were ostracized from that until such time as you could be clean. You'll also note again that the priests themselves were held to a very high standard when it came to not having any marks or blemishes on their body. The high priest especially, who was held in an even higher standard than that. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about that this morning. We covered that, and if you want to know more about that, just go back to Leviticus chapter 13 to chapter 15, and that talks a great deal more in depth about those particular conditions and the rituals that were to be enacted in order for them to be cleansed of those things. So, on to verses 5 to 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel. When a man or woman commits any of the sins of mankind, acting unfaithfully against the Lord, and that person is guilty, then he shall confess his sins which he has committed, and he shall make restitution in full for his wrong and add to it one-fifth of it, and give it to him whom he has wronged. But if the man has no relative to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution which is made for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest, besides the ram of atonement by which atonement is made for him. Also every contribution pertaining to all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they offer to the priest, shall be his. So every man's holy gift shall be his. Whatever any man gives to the priest, it becomes his." Now again, that's fairly straightforward, but there's something here concerning the nature of sin that I want to pay special attention to before we move on. Notice how the Lord explains to Moses that any of the sins of mankind, that is any sin that man might commit, is actually the equivalent of being unfaithful against the Lord. Now, this shouldn't be a strange concept, because if you're familiar with David and the Psalms, you'll recall that in Psalm 51:4, after committing adultery and murder, David prayed acknowledging, "Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge." Of course, he's speaking to the Lord there. David understood that there is very much a horizontal component to our sin. That is, we do affect one another when we sin. But the larger issue is that when we sin primarily against God Himself. And again, I think that's kind of a missing component in a lot of even professing believers' lives. I think we can sin against one another, and our first thought is what? To make it good with one another. Our natural inclination when we've wronged one another is to go to that person and seek restitution and restoration with that person. And that really shouldn't be the case at all. Our first instinct should be to immediately go to the Lord and confess that sin as a sin against Him, and not just a sin against each other. And that's not to minimize the impact that sin can have person to person. That's a very real thing. That's not to say that we don't need to make restitution to one another. We do. But our primary instinct, our primary reaction should be to go to the Lord and say, "Lord, against you I've sinned. I've sinned against this other person, but yes, I've primarily offended you, and I'm sorry for that." Now, in making restitution with one another, you'll note here that the Lord makes a provision for a 20% surcharge, if you will. If you offend someone, you not only have to make it right with them, but you also have to give them 20%. 20% of what? Well, 20% of either the perceived value of the harm done. Judges would often put monetary values on things that you have done that don't really involve money. We do the same thing in our courts today. Pain and suffering. How do you quantify someone's pain and suffering? Well, they have a way of doing that where they look at the extent of the injuries and they say, okay, that's worth X number of dollars. The best way to understand this would be to use theft as an example. If you steal something from someone, in making restitution, you're not only to give that thing back, but you're to determine the value of that thing. Let's say I steal a tool and it's worth $100 and I give it back. Now I owe $120. Now, why is that fair? How is that right? I mean, is not just restitution enough? Is it not enough to simply apologize? You know, in many cultures, that's true. Even during this particular time frame, there was nothing more required. If you do something to someone and you need to make it right with them, you go to them and you apologize and everything's back to normal. In this case, the Lord is adding this 20% surcharge so that when we sin against someone, it costs us something. Apologies are relatively cheap. Apologies might not be heartfelt. But if you have to add 20% to every sin that you commit, person to person, I think there's a great deterrent there. Especially if the judges are as crazy as some of the judges are in the world today. You know, people getting tens of millions of dollars for losing the ability to sleep well at night. I mean, come on, right? But if you wrong someone, you're going to pay for it. And this is the Lord's way of at least placing a reasonable surcharge on this type of thing. Well, on to the third and final division of the chapter, verses 11 to 31. I just want to break this up in a couple of sections as opposed to reading it all at once. But let's first look at verses 11 to 15. Read it with me. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, if any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, and a man has intercourse with her, and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, although she has defiled herself, and there's no witness against her, and she has not been caught in the act, if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife when she has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife when she has not defiled herself, the man shall then bring his wife to the priest, and shall bring as an offering for her 1/10 of an ephah of barley meal. He shall not pour oil on it, nor put frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of memorial, a reminder of iniquity." Now, that's a fairly interesting passage, right? Because now we're dealing with a condition of the heart that can't be readily seen by your fellow man. Jealousy is something that can manifest itself in inappropriate behavior, suspicion, accusation, and so on and so forth. But a lot of times jealousy is just kind of hidden, right? We're having jealous feelings, but we're really not demonstrating the fact that this has done anything to us in a profound way. And again, this is just another way of expressing the idea that God knows the condition of the heart. And when you're in a condition of jealousy, whether that jealousy is warranted or not, there needs to be an offering made for that, right? If you're jealous that your wife is having an alleged affair and it turns out that she's not, then you still owe the Lord for your jealousy, because jealousy is not something that should characterize us, right? If she is guilty, then guess what? You still owe the Lord something as a reminder of our iniquitous condition. as a reminder that these things happen. You'll notice here very carefully that there's no oil or frankincense put on it. Why would this be a similar grain offering to others but without the oil and frankincense? Well, that's easy, because oil and frankincense are, they demonstrate joy in the giver. In this case, there would be no joy. This is a very somber, very solemn occasion when this offering needed to be made. But none of this really makes a whole lot of sense until we get to verse 16. So just go there and let's read that together. Then the priest shall bring her near and have her stand before the Lord, and the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel, and he shall take some of the dust that's on the floor of the tabernacle and put it in the water. The priest shall then have the woman stand before the Lord and let the hair of the woman's head go loose, and place the grain offering of memorial in her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy, and in the hand of the priest it is to be the water of bitterness that brings a curse. The priest shall have her take an oath and shall say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray into uncleanness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings a curse. If you, however, have gone astray, being under the authority of your husband, and if you have defiled yourself, and a man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, then the priest shall have the woman swear with the oath of the curse, and the priest shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people by the Lord's making your thigh waste away and your abdomen swell, and this water that brings a curse shall go into your stomach and make your abdomen swell and your thigh waste away. And the woman shall say, amen, amen. The priest shall then write these curses on a scroll and shall wash them off into the water of bitterness. Then he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings a curse, so that the water which brings a curse will go into her and cause bitterness. The priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy from the woman's hand. He shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial offering and offer it up in smoke on the altar. And afterward, he shall make the woman drink the water. When she is made, when he has made her drink the water, then it shall come about, if she has defiled herself and has been unfaithful to her husband, that the water which brings a curse will go into her and cause bitterness, and her abdomen will swell and her thigh will waste away, and the woman will become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, she will then be free and conceive children. Wow. What does all that mean? I don't know. How does that work? Don't have a clue. I mean, it sounds like so much hocus pocus, doesn't it? It sounds like a magic trick that is not unlike those methods that they had for determining whether a woman was a witch in the Salem witch trials, right? There's all kinds of things that seem very strange to us. Now, here's the thing. In the case of the Salem witch trials, determine whether a woman was a witch or not by if she could float or not. That's all manufactured hooey, right? In this case, though, this is the Lord. And the Lord is directing that this particular thing take place as a means of determining whether or not the woman has been unfaithful. It's not normative. I don't see a repeat of this anywhere in the scriptures. There's really no indication that this was ever really carried out as it should be. I mean, surprise, surprise, the Israelites are not obedient in every respect. And it does seem like a rather laborious thing to go through to determine whether or not a woman is guilty of committing adultery. This fidelity test, the takeaway for you about this fidelity test is actually, and very simply, twofold. Number one, it was performed by God himself, because two, he is the only one who can judge the guilt or innocence of anyone in this situation, right? And so that's all that for that small little takeaway. Yeah, that's all I've got. sometimes we just are incapable of exegeting a passage without any more background, any more information to add to that. So in verses 29 to 31, the Lord does go on to clarify this process a bit. He says, this is the law of jealousy. When a wife being under the authority of her husband goes astray and defiles herself, or when a spirit of jealousy comes over a man and he is jealous of his wife, he shall then make the woman stand before the Lord, and the priest shall apply this law to her. Moreover, the man will be free from guilt, but that woman shall bear her guilt. Uh-oh. What's that sound like? Sounds like all those claims that God's a misogynist, right? God just lets the man go scot-free, and the woman has to pay the penalty. Well, that's not the case. What the Lord is doing here is showing grace to a man because the man was jealous. The man demonstrated jealousy. Okay, you know, in a lot of cases, jealousy is an indication of how much you love someone. You don't want to see them go astray. You think they might be going astray. You're jealous. Turns out you're wrong about that. This is what the Lord's saying. There's no penalty for that. You know? Try better next time, I guess. Now, if the woman's guilty, though, she needs to bear the guilt through this process, right? And again, it's easy to read passages like this and draw out the erroneous conclusion that God punishes women for their adultery but not men. That it's women who are forced to undergo this test of infidelity when there's no similar test given for men. Why might that be? Is it because God has a chauvinistic streak? Is it because God is misogynistic and he's not really a God that is worthy of our worship as women? You know, no, that's not the case at all. Remember, God established the Israelites, and this is a creation ordinance, by the way. God established the community of the Israelites to be led by men. God insists that men step up and lead their families, lead their communities. You remember that curse that God placed on Eve in the garden when he said that in addition to pain in childbirth, your desire will be for your husband. That's not a flattering thing. That's not something that's nice to think about. What is being spoken of there is that her desire would be constantly to usurp and overtake him in terms of authority. She would always want his position of authority. And we see that, don't we? Feminism, run amok in the world today, has been largely produced by this truth that the Lord spoke to Eve. I blame the men for this as much as I blame the women for trying to usurp the authority, because men have become emasculated. They've allowed it to happen. Men have stopped being the leaders in their homes. Men often don't live up to the standard that God calls them to live up to. And again, don't run off the deep end and say, well, yeah, here you are bashing men again and not bashing the women. No, women bear equal responsibility in this regard. But men, the onus is on us. Step up. Don't put your wife in the precarious position of falling for the curse that God placed on Eve. You can protect her from that. How? By leading. By being a man. Some of our young men, I don't know if this is still going on. Is Caleb here this morning? No. Okay, he might be here in the next hour, but Caleb had a really good idea of holding these periodic training sessions for young men, where we'd come together and nail nails into boards and build things and get dirty and saw things and things like this, to teach some of our young men some of those things that are missing in biblical manhood. Not only just building things and hammering things and doing all this thing, but iron sharpening iron. Men getting together, talking about what it means to be a man after God's own heart. what it means to be a leader in the home, a leader in the community. We've lost a lot of that because so many of us have abdicated our responsibility in that regard and just let the women take over. And this can be seen even in the family, can it not? Right? I don't mean to get on a soapbox this morning, and I've gone from preaching to meddling, I'm sure, but that's okay, I think, because this is a clarion call of God to all men everywhere to step up to the plate and be the men that we're called to be. Be that strong presence in the family that God has called us to be. And there's no substitute for it. You can't just relegate things to, you know, one of my pet peeves. I'm going to get in a lot of trouble with this, but it's okay. I think you guys love me, and I hope you guys love me. And I'm meeting with the women this afternoon, so women, just process this and let me have it. But in a moment, in a second of complete transparency, men, if I ask you, hey, you want to go to the game tomorrow night? Whatever. You want to go out and watch F1 cars race in Austin with me? I don't care how you have to cloak this. Do not let the first word out of your mouth be, let me check with the wife. Tell me I'll get back with you. Tell me maybe. Tell me I'd love to do that. That sounds fun. Don't tell me you need a kitchen pass. You get where I'm going with that? Be considerate of your wife. She might have other plans that she's told you about 3 times and you didn't hear her either time. Got that, right? There might be things where you're just not on the same page and you need to make sure you're on the same page. But you know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about, men. Well, I don't know if the wife... I had somebody tell me not too long ago. I asked them if they wanted to go out and have a bite to eat in the afternoon. I don't know if my wife will let me. Okay, I'm going to stop. All this to say, God's not misogynistic. God's not chauvinistic. God has placed men in our positions of leadership and authority, and the decisions we make, the stakes we drive in the ground, those are to be firm, and we're to be firmly resolved in our masculinity, in our manhood, in our, dare I say, dominion. And I know that there are some women perhaps here this morning who don't like that kind of language, they don't like that kind of talk, but that's okay because Genesis 3 says you won't like that kind of talk. Right? It rubs you the wrong way, and God said that would be the case, right? But at the end of the day, think about it. Think about how much more smoothly your family will operate if, men, you're doing your role, loving your wife as Christ loved the church. Women, if you're doing your part in submitting to your husbands as unto Christ himself. Think about how many problems can be solved if both of those things are operating optimally. And so this is not to say that men who committed adultery didn't suffer any of the fallout. They certainly did. They certainly did. God prohibits adultery. It's in the Ten Commandments. You shall not commit adultery. Jesus clarified it. Men, this is where the men get it. Men, if you look after a woman with lust in your heart, you've committed adultery with her. Make sure to understand that Jesus doesn't say the same thing to women, but that doesn't mean that it's not a quid pro quo arrangement. It doesn't mean that one gets off scot-free. We're all guilty. Do not commit adultery. Men, don't be unnecessarily jealous. Don't be automatically suspicious about everything that your wife does. That's another trap that we can fall into as well. And these are all addressed here in this passage. So, let's move on to chapter 6. Let me just read this. We'll come back next time and cover it. It concerns the Nazirite vow. Numbers chapter 6, verses 1 to 21. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazirite, to dedicate himself to the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink, nor shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh or dried grapes. All the days of his separation he shall not eat anything that's produced by the grapevine. From the seeds even to the skin, all the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall pass over his head. He shall be holy until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall let the locks of the hair on his head grow long. All the days of his separation to the Lord, he shall not go near to a dead person. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother or for his brother or for his sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. But if a man dies very suddenly beside him and he defiles his dedicated head of hair, then he shall shave his head on the day when he becomes clean. He shall shave it on the seventh day. Then on the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest, to the doorway of the tent of meeting. The priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him concerning his sin because of the dead person. And that same day he shall consecrate his head and shall dedicate to the Lord his days as a Nazirite, and shall bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering. But the former days will be void because his separation was defiled. Now this is the law of the Nazirite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, he shall bring the offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb a year old without defect for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without defect for a sin offering, and one ram without defect for a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers spread with oil, along with their grain offering and their drink offering. Then the priest shall present them before the Lord and shall offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. He shall offer the ram for a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, together with the basket of unleavened cakes. The priest shall likewise offer its grain offering and its drink offering. The Nazirite shall then shave his dedicated head of hair at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and take the dedicated hair of his head and put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of peace offerings. The priest shall take the ram's shoulder when it has been boiled, and one unleavened cake out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazirite after he has shaved his dedicated hair. Then the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. It is holy for the priest, together with the breast offered by waving and the thigh offered by lifting up, and afterward the Nazirite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazirite who vows his offering to the Lord according to his separation, in addition to what else he can afford according to his vow which he takes. So he shall do according to the law of his separation." Wow. I mean, you talk about, it'd be one thing if you had a database, you had a laptop and you're walking around, you have a database and you're like, okay, step by step, here's what I need to do in this situation. Can you imagine committing all that to memory? I don't know about you, but if I broke my Nazirite vow or needed to do something to make atonement, or, I mean, where does it end? You see that built-in sense of futility. The law is meant to instill in the one committing the sin, look, there's got to be a better way. Because what happens if you do all of this stuff, and again, you're leaving having done all of this stuff, and then you break the vow again? You got to go back and do all this stuff again. And oh, by the way, who's going to remember? I'd be walking around. I can't even go to HEB without wondering why I'm there. Right? I've literally walked in the door of HEB having gotten up, got dressed, got in my car, drove to HEB, parked in the parking lot, walked into HEB and was like, I forgot what I came for. Now, I'm not so old that it doesn't come eventually, but I've started writing things down. Can you imagine carrying this around? Okay, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do that. Aren't you grateful for the grace of God that freed us from all this? Aren't you grateful that the lone sacrifice of Christ fulfilled all of this? And we don't have to do that. We don't have to go through all of these gyrations, all of these laborious tasks. So what's a Nazarite? And how did a vow get named after him? Well, we're going to talk about that, Lord willing, in our time together next time. We're not going to go into all the detail because, again, we've gone through much of that back in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. We're not going to go back through that, the cakes and the shoulder and the shank and the thigh and the... It's not normative, and we've covered it, so we're not really going to go over that. But we are going to hit the high points of what this Nazarite vow meant when it was taken, and certainly what it meant in terms of the Lord's expectations for those who would take such a vow. So.